Welcome to Podcast 11 on the Cuban Revolution. My name is Dr. Benjamin Bryce. This is History 281, Republican Latin America at the University of Northern British Columbia. Today, I'm going to talk about four points related to the Cuban Revolution. First, the causes and ideology driving the Cuban Revolution before their successful rise to power of Fidel Castro and others, so in the 1950s in particular. Then I want to talk about the revolutionary policies of the Cuban Revolution, then the United States' response to this revolution, and the broader impact of this revolution on other parts of Latin America. So to my first point on the causes and ideology of the Cuban Revolution. An important bit of background information on this 1959 revolution is that there was another revolution in Cuba in 1933. Soon after, a man named Fulgencio Batista comes to power in 1934. He's officially not president until 1940, but from 1934 until 1944, he's effectively the person in charge of Cuba. And he has a series of policies which are important background information for what later becomes opposition to him in the 1950s. So first of all, in this first period of power from 34 to 44, Batista makes an alliance with the Communist Party. He has a series of populist reforms. He passes a law on female suffrage, passes a new constitution that's quite progressive in 1940. So he's a left-of-center politician, embracing a popular governing style elsewhere in Latin America of populism in the 1930s. So the timing of this is quite similar to that of Cuba and Brazil and then Argentina in the 1940s. But when Batista returns to power, so he loses power in 1944, he returns to power in 1952, and it is in power up until the time that Fidel Castro comes to power, his policies are much different. So then the opposition to Batista in the 1950s is not only an opposition to a right-wing repressive dictatorship, but also an opposition to someone who himself in the 1930s and 40s had been the ally of labor and making a series of progressive reforms that appeal to the vast majority of Cubans. So he comes to power in 1952 with a coup. He rejects his previous populist stance, the context of the Cold War now in the early 1950s and the support of the United States and the United States' desire to support someone who is not a leftist populist, but rather more in line with the military and clearly following U.S. interests, leads him to reject his previous populist stance. He suspends the 1940 Constitution and is increasingly dependent on the United States for support. He bans the Communist Party, and his ruling strategy in the 1950s is based on repression rather than reforms appealing to workers. So as Fidel Castro leads a guerrilla campaign or a guerrilla war against the Batista regime in the second half of the 1950s, from 1956 up until the successful revolution in January 1950, or the successful completion of the revolution in January 1959, Castro is leading what he calls a moral campaign against Batista. So it's a moral campaign against this military repressive figure, very much dependent on American support. American support is very important in this in 1950s Cuba, so much so that when the United States finally does withdraw its support from Batista in 1958, that is sort of the end of his possibility of beating Castro or repelling this guerrilla war that's increasingly advancing from east to west in Cuba, which ultimately leads to Batista going into exile in the United States and the declaration of a new government in January 1959. The United States is quick to recognize the new Castro government, so it's fully abandoned its support of Batista by the time Castro comes to power. Castro's on the cover of Time magazine in late January 1959. But what initially looks like a working relationship quickly sours and leads to a series of American efforts to overthrow the newly established Castro regime or government. So a key feature of the Castro revolution is anti-imperialism. Anti-imperialism or anti-American economic dominance of Cuba is central in driving the revolutionaries and central in getting them support from the vast majority of Cubans. So in particular, they're very critical of U.S. economic exploitation of Cuba, of its resources, on particular things like the sugar industry, but then also the tourist industry. And once coming to power in 1959, this anti-imperialism remained something central to the Castro government. An important and tangible marker of that anti-imperialism is that Cuba, in the 1960s and into the 1970s, seeks alliances with the non-aligned movement with other countries, not wishing to fall into the camp of either the American sphere of influence or the Soviet sphere of influence. So much so that Fidel Castro is in fact the general secretary of the non-aligned movement between 1979 and 1983. This anti-imperialism also spreads elsewhere in Latin America. Cuba fosters anti-imperial revolutions and revolutionaries elsewhere in the region, and they're identifying a problem with North-South relations, Latin American-U.S. relations, in the context of the Cold War, that is increasingly to the benefit of the United States. And so Cuba sees this as a problem, labels it imperialism, and dedicates itself to opposing this imperialist project of the United States. To my second point on revolutionary policies. So particularly in the 1960s, this was a period of intense popular mobilization. A series of mass organizations were formed. There's a spirit of volunteerism in taking hold in Cuban society, and the government enacts two really important reforms which have a lasting impact up until today. One is major health reforms. The Rural Health Service, a government agency, was founded in 1960. It brings all doctors into the public system starting by the mid-1960s. And another one which had a lasting impact on Cuban society and which also received a huge amount of popular support was a revolutionary policy in education and literacy. So starting in 1960, Cuba passes a law on universal education and launches a nationwide campaign against illiteracy starting in 1961. And they use all this revolutionary language to describe and describe the project and mobilize the population. So spelling brigades are founded in which urban and middle-class people committed to the revolution go out to rural areas to spread literacy. So it's a massive project with popular mobilization, and it's massively successful. So it turns Cuba into... transforms Cuba in the course of a decade to being a highly literate Caribbean society. It makes it stand out compared to most of its neighbors, still dependent on very exploitative labor, plantation economies. And in a way, Cuba, any criticism of the Cuban Revolution also should keep in mind these important transformations, these social projects of the Cuban Revolution. So the anti-imperialism projects of the Cuban Revolution also, though, have a socialist bent. They are sort of necessarily positioning Cuba in opposition to the United States, whether or not they were interested in capitalism or socialism, but their anti-imperialism means that the thing that the Cuban Revolution wants to upend is Cuba's exploited relationship with the United States. And as a result, it brings Cuba into the new Cuban government into conflict with the U.S. government. So within months of coming to power, in May 1959, the Castro government passes a thing called the Agrarian Reform. It expropriates large estates and also prevents any foreign ownership of land. So in a sense, Castro is being shaped here by his previous experiences in Guatemala in the early 1950s with the idea of having agrarian reform for the benefit of the majority and at the expense of large corporations which are foreign owned and largely American. The Castro government, though also perhaps seeking its non-aligned status, but can be read very easily as pro-communist, signs a trade agreement with the Soviet Union in 1960. The Soviet Union pledges industrial equipment in exchange for sugar. So it's a way to help the Cuban economy industrialize and move away from its sugar dependency, while also relying on this main economic source of main economic productivity, which is the sugar economy. And third, which something that could be read as anti-imperialism or anti-Americanism, Fidel Castro nationalizes U.S.-owned oil refineries. The United States responds to this, especially in the context of early 1960s Cold War context. There's an escalation. The United States stops all sugar imports from Cuba And in retaliation to that, the Cuban government nationalizes all other U.S. companies still in Cuba. So electrical, telephone, and sugar consortiums. And in response to that, the United States starts a general trade embargo. So all of a sudden, there's this rapid escalation of Cuban-American relations and a total breakdown of any sort of economic relationship which had dominated Cuba over the previous 60 years. Within 2 years of the Cuban Revolution, January 1961, U.S. President Eisenhower breaks diplomatic relations with Cuba and plays an important role or orchestrates through the CIA, the United States orchestrates an invasion of Cuba using Cuban exiles as the soldiers or the mercenaries in April 1961 in this famous Bay of Pigs invasion. Bay of Pigs is the name of the bay, and it leads to... It's unsuccessful and also gets Castro far more support because it provides evidence for this American imperialism and sort of an American invasion of the Cuban Revolution. So it's quite helpful to cement the power of the Castro regime. Over the course of the early 1960s, the CIA attempts several assassinations of Castro. So very quickly, because of this economic breakdown and this clear socialist turn in Cuban economic and trade policies, the United States sees Cuba and Castro as an enemy and a real problem in the context of the Cold War, particularly its proximity to the United States and its the fact that Cuba is in Latin America, a sphere that the United States sees as something that cannot be communist in the context of the Cold War. This breakdown in Cuban-American relations continues. The United States plays a leading role in expelling Cuba from the Organization of American States in 1962. And the Organization of American States, which is an organization, a U.S.-led Cold War strategy but that incorporates almost all countries in Latin America, supports a trade embargo of Cuba for its communist tendencies, and it does so in 1964. The United States has a few other policies as a way to sort of denounce the Cuban regime and present the United States as the savior to this communist state that's emerging in the Caribbean. So in 1962, the United States passes legislation called the Migration and Refugee Assistance Act, which, unlike any other country in Latin America, gives Cubans the special status to come to the United States and legally, and in so doing, it encourages a large number of Cubans to leave Cuba, especially a large number of affluent Cubans, and bringing their wealth with them as a way to sort of undermine the Cuban economy. Over the course of the 1960s, about 500,000 Cubans leave. This is both a marker of an American attempt to show its superiority or its attractiveness over Cuba, but also as a way, also proof that many of the changes in Cuba were not met with universal approval by a very large number of Cubans. My fourth point, the impact on Latin America. As a result of the Cuban Revolution and as a result of the United States not being able to contain the Cuban Revolution or stop the Cuban Revolution and quickly replace Castro with a more U.S.-friendly dictatorship, United States foreign policy towards elsewhere in Latin America hardens. In the context of the Cold War, the Cuban rejection of U.S. economic control and its embrace of the Soviet Union and the non-aligned movement are a major blow to U.S. foreign policy in the area where U.S. foreign policy has seen itself as apparently 100% dominant. The Cuban Revolution, so on the one hand, that affects U.S. foreign policy towards the Americas, but it also affects how the right wing or conservative groups in Latin American countries also view progressive reforms. So progressive reforms are increasingly seen as a communist threat in a way that in the 1950s they might have been just seen as socially oriented reforms. And in a sense, the Latin American right is taking advantage of U.S. fears about communism, but to their own benefit to stamp out any attempts at progressive reforms for the benefit of the masses and at the detriment of elites. So all the anti-reform coups that took place in Latin America in the 1960s and 1970s had the Cuban Revolution in mind. So in Brazil, there was a coup in 1964. The military cracks down on a reformist government. In the Dominican Republic in 1965, and in Chile in 1973. The idea of the social reforms of the democratically elected leaders, being a real threat, a communist threat to national security, is what motivates the militaries of these countries to go down the path of dictatorship. The Latin American left is also greatly affected by the Cuban Revolution. Cuba becomes a symbol of anti-imperialism and is a success story that could be emulated elsewhere. The military strategies of the Cuban Revolution, this guerrilla warfare, what is called focal theory, or these small vanguard groups giving focus to this guerrilla war, becomes a tactic used elsewhere. So first, very directly, the Cuban Revolution, an important figure in the Cuban Revolution, Ernesto Guevara, or Che Guevara, tries to export this focal theory and this revolutionary spirit of the Cuban Revolution to Bolivia in 1967. It ends in failure. But in Argentina, between 1973 and 1983, the guerrilla resistance to the government and later the military dictatorship, and in Nicaragua and Guatemala in the 1980s, they're also embracing the military strategies, this focal theory of the Cuban Revolution. To conclude, the Cuban Revolution has a nationalist element. Its anti-American imperialism, on the one hand, could be read as socialist and communist, but at the same time, it's also pro-Cuban and anti-American. And that's another important way to understand the Cuban Revolution. The Cuban Revolution has an important education, health, and economic reforms in the 1960s, and it's revolutionary not only in the rise to power, the successful overthrow of the Batista government, but also it's revolutionary in the policies that the revolutionary government enacted after coming to power in 1959. The Cuban Revolution affects U.S. foreign policy. The Cuban case also affects both the right and the left elsewhere in Latin America.